This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Meffert Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffert.
Thank you, everybody, for being with us again. So much ahead this hour, and I just want to kick things off by thanking each and every one of you who have been helping us to support the great work of Heart for Lebanon. We are doing so well in our campaign, but if you have been thinking about helping Heart for Lebanon continue to reach out with the gospel of Jesus Christ, with food, with education, Christian education, to these Muslim refugee children who are in this tent city, they're in Lebanon, several tent cities, then you still have time to do it. As we are moving through the rest of the week, the number to call is 866-485-9187. Your gift of $98 will help to rescue 18 of these children and bring them to the Heart for Lebanon Hope Centers, where they can learn and be fed and, most importantly, come to know the Lord Jesus Christ. It's a great missionary opportunity. So many of these kids are coming to the Lord. Their parents are coming to the Lord. It is a fabulous outreach. And if you can give anything today, please, please call 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Well, lucky us, Planned Parenthood has a new president. Cecile Richards has faded into the background. No surprise there. Cecile Richards was under tremendous fire for baby body parts trafficking, and that was not going so well for Cecile. So she took off. Now we have a new woman in her place. The new president's name is Dr. Lena Wen. She is actually a physician, the first physician in about a half century, according to CBS, to head up Planned Parenthood, the abortion giant. And she did what I would like to call a Pravda-esque propaganda interview on CBS this morning, this week. It was awful. It was only a few minutes long, but it was absolutely awful. Talk about avoiding all the potholes. They did their level best to make sure that they could avoid all the uncomfortable parts of discussing Planned Parenthood. So first they threw her this softball question. So what do you plan to bring to the job of president of Planned Parenthood? Listen to cut one.
Well, this is deeply personal to me. I was a patient of Planned Parenthood, and so was my mother and my sister, just like one in five women in America. And as a doctor, I am proud to lead our organization as we deliver life-saving care to 2.5 million people every year.
Why did your family use Planned Parenthood?
When we first came to this country, my mother didn't have health care anywhere else. And Planned Parenthood was there for her, just as it's there for women across the country, to provide cancer screenings, to provide birth control. We do more to prevent unintended pregnancies every year than any other organization.
Okay. All right. A couple of red flags right there. Are you really trying to say that your mother had no other options for healthcare than Planned Parenthood when she came to this country? I really want the details on that, because that sounds like a canned PR claim. Just wondering. And did you note the, this is deeply personal for me? That they always say that. Cecile Richards used that phrase all the time. Deeply personal. I mean, this woman has been so coached. In fact, she's so coached on what she should say. She not only throws around all the similar pet phrases to Cecile Richards, but her sound bites are almost all in 30-second increments. I was timing it, and I said, this woman is unbelievable. She probably spent hours sitting in some conference room with the Planned Parenthood operatives. Now, make sure it's long enough to say something, but short enough that people don't get bored. Okay, well, you can hear for yourself. Hopefully you won't get bored. But life-saving care, yeah, that's what you're known for, life-saving care. Let's look back at the statistics on Planned Parenthood for the year 2016-2017, in which 321,384 innocent unborn children were murdered by Planned Parenthood. What was that again about life-saving care? All right. Now, they asked her, do you have at all any trepidation, or did you have any trepidation about taking this job since you are the mom of a 14-month-old baby and you are a practicing emergency room physician? This is what she said. Cut to.
Being a parent has clarified my values, and what I want to do is to shape the future for my son, Eli. And it's a future where all people are treated the same, that all people have the right to health care, mm-hmm. and where it's a society where we trust women and we trust all people to make the best decisions for themselves and their bodies.
What does that even mean? What does that even mean? That, I mean, they need better PR operatives over at Planned Parenthood, because that was nonsensical. Being a parent has clarified your values, so you've decided you want to head up the organization that murders more children than any abortion giant in America. How does that clarify? You know, it wasn't until I had a baby that I really wanted to head up an organization that would kill hundreds of thousands of them every single year and shape the future for my 14-month-old baby, who is fortunate enough to make it out of the womb alive. Oh, she left off that phrase. Right to health care. Abortion is not health care. Was she encouraged, though, by the election results? This is what Dr. Wen said on this score. This is cut three.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we saw people rise up, women, people of color rise up to speak in favor of reproductive rights and access to health care. But on the other hand, less than 24 hours after the elections, the Trump administration came out with new rules that would prevent employers, or actually that would allow employers, to deny women birth control coverage. Mm-hmm. I can't believe it's 2018 and we're still debating birth control. Mm-hmm. Imagine if we're having the same conversation about vasectomies or about insulin. Women's healthcare is healthcare, and healthcare shouldn't be political.
Oh, please give me a break. Healthcare shouldn't be political. Abortion is political, and you get over $500 million of our taxpayer money every single year. If you don't think there should be any political component to abortion and your funding sources, then how about you give that money back? Absolutely insane listening to this garbage. By the way, the Trump administration put out these two rules, as we know, just a few days ago, finalizing the interim rules regarding people's religious objections to covering abortion-inducing contraception and other kinds of contraceptives. The first one provided an exemption to the contraceptive mandate in Obamacare for individuals and entities who have religious objections. And the second one provided an exemption to nonprofit groups and other people and small businesses who have moral opposition to such coverage. Guess what, Dr. Wen? Not everybody thinks that birth control and especially abortion-inducing drugs are a good thing. And it has nothing to do with 2018. It's 2018. All right. Then they asked her, well, you say that being a mom clarified your values, but people who want to restrict abortion rights say their values were shaped when they became mothers, too. So what would you tell those people? Cut four.
I respect each person's beliefs for themselves. My problem is if they want to impose their own beliefs on other people. As a physician, I trust my patients. My job is to give medically accurate information to my patients and allow them to make the best choices about their health. I don't think that politicians have any role to play in the exam room in determining people's personal medical decisions. I trust women.
I trust women. I trust women. Okay, if you don't believe politicians should be involved, give us our money back. $530 million. What was it that you got from the government last year? The taxpayers through the government? It's just crazy. Then she was asked about the possibility of Roe versus Wade being overturned at the Supreme Court. This is Cut Five.
There is a very real likelihood that Roe versus Wade could be overturned in this Supreme Court, which would leave 25 million women, which is a third of women of reproductive age in this country, without access to reproductive rights.
Not Roe versus Wade itself, but essentially some other case that comes through that restricts abortion rights?
Well, there are 15 cases right now that are just one step away from the Supreme Court. And in the last 7 years, there have been 400 laws passed in different states that directly restrict women's access. And I am deeply concerned about this from a public health perspective.
Deeply concerned, deeply personal. I trust women. I trust women. I trust women. We get it. The same old story. Planned Parenthood is the greatest, except The figures do not lie. And when you look at how many people have been murdered by Planned Parenthood, and when you look at the baby body parts trafficking scandal, for which they still not have fully paid a just penalty for what they did, it's all just smoke and mirrors. Planned Parenthood is about abortion. Let's never forget that fact. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Did you know that this fall you can help create the next great Christian missionary force? It's true. Right now in Lebanon, there are 2 million refugees who are living in tent settlements, and they're really the innocent victims of the brutal Syrian civil war. Did you know more than half of them are children who are at great risk of Islamic radicalization and sex trafficking? Many of them have only their mothers. But in the midst of the darkness, Heart for Lebanon is offering the hope of the gospel. They have wonderful hope centers there in Lebanon, and there they feed these children. They give them a Christian education. And most importantly, they introduce them to our Savior for the very first time. The stories are incredible, and hearts are really open right now as the Lord changes their lives and brings them to a saving knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. But right now, we need your help. Your gift of $22 will rescue four children who come to these hope centers and find a Christian education and get fed, which is what they need. They need basic care. They need basic education. And most of all, they need the gospel. Now, if you can give a gift of $98, you'll be rescuing 18 children. This is an entire classroom full of kids. Will you please help us help these children? They will go home one day and then they'll be able to reach their nations for Christ. What an opportunity the Lord is giving to us right now. If you can call and help, here's the number. 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Once again, 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Please pray and please give whatever you can while the Lord works in the lives of these children. What a great opportunity to create the next great Christian missionary force. The number to call again, 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187. Thank you so much for whatever you can do. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. As I was just saying a couple of minutes ago, the Trump administration has released two of these final rules on protecting the religious freedom of pro-life entities, one providing an exemption from Obamacare's contraceptive mandate related to religious objections, and the other rule exempts nonprofit groups and individuals and small businesses who have moral opposition to such coverage. But now that the Democrats have won control of the House, my next guest says it's more important than ever for pro-life lawmakers to stand up for the unborn, which is great. Tom McCluskey is president of March for Life Action and recently penned a piece over at The Hill. Dems in the House now threaten pro-life movement, and he joins us now. Tom, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing today?
Doing fine. I think you're absolutely right. This is now a game changer again. The Republicans have lost control of the House. What are your concerns about what might happen now in terms of the pro-life momentum being blocked?
Well, one, this will be, and this is said of probably every time the Democrats take power and every time it's true, but this is a pretty radical Democratic caucus that's coming in and will be the most pro-abortion caucus that we've ever seen.
Yeah.
Those leading all the committees, especially the key committees like appropriations and judiciary, as well as the speaker herself, are some of the most pro-abortion people ever elected to office. And on top of that, I did some math, and there's out of about 190 or so Republicans who are returning, only 51 of them have ever served in the minority before. So 75% of the Republicans don't even know what to expect come January.
Wow.
So this is of concern to me because the first thing on the chopping block for Democrats is going to try to weaken pro-life laws that we currently have on the books, weaken what President Trump has done in the pro-life arena. Quite honestly, I don't trust the backdrop of the U.S. Senate to uphold those.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We have to watch both houses of Congress for sure. Well, one of the frustrations I know for a lot of pro-lifers was the inability of the Republicans who are controlling the House to defund Planned Parenthood. I suppose that's going to be put back on the back burner for sure now the Democrats are in charge. And that's when a lot of pro-lifers are really frustrated about. Why didn't that get done while they had the chance?
And it's a frustration that, unfortunately, I wish was echoed more here in Washington, D.C. It's one that I've talked to a number of members about. You saw a couple of members this last time around, like say Jim Banks or Warren Davidson, who voted against the large omnibus bill over Planned Parenthood spending, despite the fact they mostly supported everything else in the bill. And while it's on the back burner because there's no way that Nancy Pelosi would defund one of her biggest, one of the biggest Democratic Party contributors, campaign contributors, it should give some leverage to the Republican Senate and to President Trump to be able to start talking about Planned Parenthood and why Planned Parenthood, being the largest abortion provider in the world and also tied to some pretty despicable things, should be separated from the federal government wallet. And sometimes it takes some drastic measures to get that message across because I know organizations like yourself, your own and ASA are always talking about it, but get the Washington Post to talk about the bad things that Planned Parenthood does. You need the president to stand up or the Senate to stand up and say, we're going to defund them and we'll shut down the government.
Yeah, it's been really a shame. Well, you had mentioned, for example, the leadership changes. We might get Nancy Pelosi again. We'll see how that goes as House Speaker. But you also mentioned Congressman Jerry Nadler. He's a big pro-abortion Democrat who could end up as head of the Judiciary Committee. What kinds of concerns do you specifically have about him that could derail the pro-life cause? What might be on tap under his leadership that would be affected?
Well, he's from the New York City area. Are around that area. And one thing that the state of New York has been doing is attacking pregnancy care centers. And I would not be surprised if we saw something from the Judiciary Committee going after these pregnancy care centers, one of the most vulnerable, I think, and the most honest of the pro-life movement, those who are directly on the front line. Additionally, what we're fearful of is that the Judiciary Committee is where pro-life legislation goes whenever it's introduced. So, of course, it's not going to get a fair hearing at any point in that committee.
Right. Well, what is in the pipeline at the moment that is most pressing, would you say, to get through? In other words, what pieces of legislation might you be the most concerned that now will be derailed?
Well, as you mentioned, there's the funding Planned Parenthood that if it's not done in the next couple of months, it's not going to be done. Probably at the very least 2 years. There's conscience protection, something that since Obamacare passed back in 2010, pro-life healthcare professionals have been forced to have to perform or participate in abortion. Their churches out in California have been forced to have to pay for them in their insurance plan. What we've been pushing for is language within the appropriations process that would protect those entities. And unfortunately, this is another place that the Republicans consistently just drop the ball, despite this is a popular issue. This is something we'd like to see done in the next couple of months, beyond what the administration is hoping is going to be doing in the next couple of months as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what about the House Appropriations Committee? Because that committee could do certain things. It's going to be tougher, of course, with Democrats in charge. But what sorts of pro-life administration policies, for example, are potentially in jeopardy right now, or what kinds of appropriation bills are in jeopardy?
Well, consistently, the Mexico City policy, which protects taxpayer funds for paying for abortions overseas.
Right.
And this is something the president does, that President Trump did within his first month in office, that is consistently under attack. And in the Senate, you actually have a pro-abortion majority on the Senate Appropriations Committee, or at least did in the last Congress. That's a very major concern. Title 10 regulations, which help separate and make sure that Title 10 funds don't go to entities like Planned Parenthood that perform abortion. The president is just about to finalize his new regulations to make sure that separation happens. I would expect that would be under fire as well.
Yeah.
And there's a number of other appropriations, within appropriations, a number of other public concerns, mostly focused on the labor HHS portion of things, including the simple fact that since Obamacare passed, right now congressional staff can get abortions paid for by taxpayers through their insurance plan. This is something that's supposed to be illegal because there is an amendment within appropriations and language within the appropriations supposed to stop that, but it's never been enforced. And now that's certainly under jeopardy to be erased completely.
Yeah, brother, that's awful. You also say the Senate should speed up the judicial and the executive branch nominations. Where does all that stand right now, and what would you like to see happen in the Senate in a positive direction?
Well, in a positive direction, there are over 100 administration positions that need to be filled. And there are over, and this is where the administration has to work with the Senate, there are close to 200 judicial positions that need to be filled.
Wow.
Some of them that have been sent to the Senate, some that the administration hasn't even named yet. It's important to get those through as quickly as possible. The Democrats have been filibustering slowing down some of these nominees. But the simple fact is, in the last year, the Senate only worked 3 Fridays out of 365 days.
Wow.
And they didn't work any Mondays that I'm aware of. Working a week Monday through Friday, most of us do, even on holidays like Veterans Day, would certainly speed up this process and make the Democrats cry a little bit more and hopefully give us a few more of those nominations.
Yeah, get to work. You know, that's
exactly.
Crazy. Yeah. Well, what about President Trump in particular? Because you had mentioned in your article at The Hill about the possibility of him issuing a veto threat if legislation have pro-life policies stripped away. What can the president do? What would you think would be the best move for him to keep things going in a good pro-life direction?
Well, this is something that both President George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush did during their administrations when they were facing a pro-abortion majority. They sent letters saying, if you change current policy, I will veto the bill. And in a way that draws a line in the sand where you are not the one shutting down the government. It's the Democratic pro-abortion majority that's shutting down the government. If you let them know, this is current pro-life policy, many of it has been pro-life policy for 40 years, I will veto any bill that changes that.
That's good. Do you have confidence, a fair amount of confidence, that the president would be willing to do that? That's well within his wheelhouse, given his personality, that he would be willing to do that. But do you have any indication that he actually would?
I'm hoping to find out that I'm more definite this week. The House and Senate are certainly moving to make similar promises, except it is something that the administration needs to do, and that will be my major thing I'll be working on.
Good. Well, it's so important to keep a close eye on what's going on. And I really liked what you had to say at the end of your article, Tom, when you said, make no mistake, incoming Speaker Pelosi's priority will be to repay favors now owed to special interest groups on the left who poured hundreds of millions of dollars into this election to achieve a Democrat victory. And now is the time for pro-life members in both chambers to shrug off their innate wariness of actual engagement and stand up for the pro-life issue, which they've always run on. Really important stuff. Tom McCluskey, president of March for Life Action. Thanks a lot for being here, Tom. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. There is no doubt that the book that public school children most need to learn from and about is the Bible. But what is the link between Bible study and increased academic success? Well, Essentials in Education, which publishes the Bible and its influence, the only academic textbook on the Bible that has been deemed First Amendment safe, they recently commissioned a new study on that issue, and the results inspired the organization to create a new course for inclusion in the Teach the Bible in Schools curriculum. It is called Wisdom Literature from the Bible. And I'm excited to hear more now from Chuck Stetson, who is CEO of Essentials in Education. Chuck, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
Great. It's great to be with you, Janet.
Thank you. Well, people may be familiar, I'm sure, with Essentials in Education and how you are able to instruct kids in the Bible in public schools. A lot of people ask the question, how is that even legal? And I'm sure you get that question a lot, don't you?
Well, we get it sometimes. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the Bible may be taught academically in public schools within the First Amendment. I think it's pretty interesting that one of the things that we did is that we went together with the, we called up the First Amendment Center. They had done a little brochure called Religion and Public Schools, a First Amendment Guide. And I picked up the phone and said, well, what about the Bible? And they said, well, what do you have in mind? And I explained, and the guy was in my office 2 weeks later, and 11 months later, we had the Bible and Public Schools, a First Amendment Guide, which was endorsed. We published it with the, co-published it with the First Amendment Center, but it was endorsed by the National School Boards Association, the American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association, Christian groups, Jewish groups, and we even had the people for the American Way, so we had actually had secular groups. So Everyone across the board said, this is something we should do, or agreed that we could do it. And then we, from that, we took it to the next step of just because it's legal, should you do it? We did two studies that the Templeton Foundation funded. One was with National High School English teachers that found that 96% of high school English teachers, that's 96%, said that kids are disadvantaged when reading English literature if they don't know the Bible. And we had university English professors at these very secular universities like Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Stanford, and University of California. There were 39 of them, and 100% agreed that an educated person, regardless of their faith, knows the Bible.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, now you have this data from this meta study that was just done talking about this link between knowing the Bible and having increased academic success. Tell us a little bit about why that study was conducted and what the findings were.
Well, the why of we conducted the study is that we've been teaching the Bible academically in public schools since 2005. We reached 650 high schools in 45 states have purchased it. We've reached 150,000 students. And one of the things we observed is that the kids are really having a good time. They're coming in knowing absolutely nothing about the Bible, or pretty close to nothing in most cases. And 72% leave the course saying that to us that they're continuing to read the Bible. You know, we thought, well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
What else is going on? And so we commissioned this study to see whether character might have something to do with it. And what they did is what's called a meta study. They looked at 40 studies, and it correlated good biblical values, love, integrity, compassion, and self-discipline with grades. And it, guess what? When character is taught, the grades go up. What parent is not going to be thrilled with grades going up?
Right. Yeah, that's right. Well, what do you believe? I mean, it seems kind of obvious on its face why there would be that correlation, but did they extrapolate on why that correlation exists, what the direct connection is, why that is, in other words, the result is what it
is?
No,
but No, but I can do that a little bit myself, because we've had instances of history. We might go back to William Wilberforce. I did a film for PBS, a one-hour documentary for PBS, and as I was studying William Wilberforce, what I saw is that he took a very terrible situation in England in the late 18th century. We get the term highway robbery. Where does that come from? It comes from the fact that between towns in England at the time, they would have robbers at high noon robbing people. Hmm. That's what highway robberies come from. It was a terrible time. You had like 20% of the kids died before they were age 5, and you know, it was just a horrible time. 25% of the women in London were prostitutes. Young women. I mean, it was just a horrible time. He turned it around with his friends, and it became what eventually became Victorian England. When they started to look at values, and they started to really come to biblical values, wow, the whole place changed. And you didn't have robberies on the highway. The London was cleaned up. You didn't have all this prostitution and all of that. It was just an amazing thing, and people actually started to pray again. Hmm. And all of that. And so I think that just sort of looking at that element of history, it's pretty clear to me that when you've had revivals, and people get kind of on that, it really does clean up the situation, and people get focused, and that they would get better grades. I'm not the least surprised.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. Now, you've got this new curriculum, Wisdom Literature from the Bible. I know this focuses on books like Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. Tell us a little bit about this new curriculum.
Well, what we did is that when I started out in 1996, they had a Gallup study that said 75% of Americans want to see the Bible taught in public schools. And it's held pretty steady. The recent survey that we did about a year ago was up to 80%. But people want to see it. How many schools do it? It turns out only 8% of schools teach it. And when they teach it currently, he teaches an elective, so only 25% of the class, typically of high school seniors, will get exposed to it. So you're reaching 2% of the 51 million kids in public schools. It's just unacceptable.
Right.
And the way we thought about it is, well, Proverbs, that's kind of interesting. That's been taught for 3,000 years in schools. And if you look at Proverbs, you'll find it keeps on repeating, my son, my son, my son. It was all a boy. This was taught to a boys' school.
Yeah.
They also work women in, because wisdom is actually female in the Proverbs. But the key thing is that the character was taught for 3,000 years, except for the last 50 years. And, you know, a part of what our problems today, I think the lack of civility that we see in the elections and all of that, people are upset about. We need to come, this is almost like a William Wilberforce moment, where if people started to come back and look at the Bible seriously and take it seriously, a lot of stuff would get cleaned up. And it certainly got cleaned up in Britain between the late 18th century and the early 19th century. And I think we could have the same thing happen to us again. And I really hope that we do. And clearly what this is doing, this meta-study, it's just documenting. And what I like is the documentation, because if someone comes back and says, well, I'm not sure about that, I said, look at the documentation. Right. This is a document. This is not something we're speculating about. And, you know, what parent would want to not see their kid get better grades?
Yes, exactly. Get better grades and have better character and have better behavior.
Better character.
And the teachers, too. Better behavior is always good for teachers.
Yeah. And then the other thing is that we believe, you see, this can now be worked into a world literature course where it always was and has just gotten carved out. So with the 3-week reader that we have, This can be worked into a world literature course. And the nice part about it is that when we did the Bible and its influence, we had to get school board permission for a semester or a full year course. For a three-week course, the teacher can make that decision usually themselves.
Very good.
And so that's even better that they can work it in, and it needs to be worked in.
Well, I'll tell you what, hang on a moment. Chuck Stetson with us from Essentials in Education. We're going to come back talking more about the Bible in public schools. We'll return on Janet Mefford Today. How can Christians stand on God's word at a time when radical activists want to compromise the church on the issue of biblical sexuality? A rising tide of LGBT activism is becoming apparent inside our churches. Wearing a religious facade, these activists talk about LGBT Christians and sexual minorities, and their goal is to move our churches away from the word of God. It's time for the church to defend biblical truth without compromise. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the God's Voice Conference, a biblical response to the queering of the church. Sponsored by First Stone Ministries, God's Voice will bring clarity to the confusion surrounding revoiced sexuality and identity. Our team of experts will demonstrate how the language of the LGBT Christian movement is rooted not in the Bible, but in the same ideology that has wreaked havoc on our culture. The God's Voice Conference will take place February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City, and we want to see you there. It's time for the church to bow the knee to God's voice. To register or for more information, visit godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you for joining us. And it's great to have with us Chuck Stetson, who is CEO of Essentials in Education. You can check them out at teachthebibleinschools.org. They have created The Bible and Its Influence, which is the only academic textbook on the Bible that is in the public schools. And they are out now with a new curriculum in the Teach the Bible in Schools curriculum titled Wisdom Literature from the Bible. You had mentioned, Chuck, before we went to the break, that unlike the previous textbook, this one is a three-week course that the teacher can select. So how does this all work? If you have people listening who say, oh, I'm a teacher, I'd love to incorporate this into my curriculum, how do I go about doing it?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to double check with the schools, the parents and the grandparents. We've all had kids go to schools, and we know the teachers in the community, and we just go and say, are you teaching any of this stuff? Are you teaching the Proverbs? Are you teaching the Bible in your school? And if not, why not?
Right.
We have to turn this around. We're going to be at a point, I think, within a couple of years. Now you have to find a reason to teach the Bible and the like. I think we're going to reach a point where you're going to find a situation where you have to find a reason not to teach it because it's going to be so widespread. I mean, already we've got 9 states that have passed legislation encouraging their schools in their respective states to teach the Bible. And I think that what this course on wisdom literature, it really is for all the students, and it's really unacceptable not to be teaching it. And so I think that, if they go and talk to the first thing, step is to talk to teachers, see whether it's being done. Probably not. And then get the teachers excited. The teachers know the process to go through what you have to do. If you have to teach a semester or full year course, then you have to go through the school boards. But more than likely, they can probably just incorporate it. And virtually every school has a world literature course. This needs to be part of it, and it needs to be a priority. And I think that that's one of the things that the listeners can all go and do themselves. And I think that indeed we really have to. I mean, you've got three things going for you. We've already mentioned character. We've already mentioned, that the kids do better and get better grades. But the other thing is that without the Bible, kids cannot really understand the world around them. They can't understand fully the English language, English literature, history, art, music, and culture. Again, that really isn't acceptable. In the plays of Shakespeare, there are 36 plays of Shakespeare. There are 1,200 documented references to the Bible in Shakespeare. I submit that if you do not know the Bible, you cannot possibly know Shakespeare.
Right. Oh, absolutely. It's so true, because it's just pervasive, the biblical references in so much of the literature that we even read in high school. I sometimes wonder about that. If you have a lot of kids in public schools reading some of these old books, if they even understand the reference. And I would imagine a lot of them don't, if they don't know the Bible.
Well, you just take Herman Melville's Moby Dick. You can't get past the first sentence.
Yeah.
Call me Ishmael.
Right.
Oh, wait a sec. I'm sorry. The Norton Anthology has a footnote. It says a wanderer.
Oh.
I think that's exactly what Herman Melville expected you to know.
Really? That's what they put in the Norton? Oh, man. That's crazy. That's crazy. Well, this is great. Now, how do you incorporate, how does it work? In other words, when you are presenting the wisdom literature from the Bible and a teacher is going through this course, how do you get the information to the kids? Do you take certain sections of Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and they go through a section, or do you do it topically? How do you do it?
Well, we've done a teacher training. We had 174 high school teachers that I trained back in August, and they were thrilled. And what really excited them more than anything else is that I walked them through. I did the 23rd Psalm. I did some stuff in Proverbs, and then I did some stuff in Job. And I sort of brought it back. And here's the thing, kids are, as we all know, pretty much everywhere in the world. They're under a lot of pressure as a high school senior. What college am I going to get into? Where are my friends going to go? They're all dealing with at some aspect of family breakup. We've got far too many breakups of family, which we shouldn't have.
Yeah.
We've got the teenage problems you normally have anyway. We've got kids that are depressed. And it's a good number. It's like 50 or 60% of the numbers that I'm seeing. But we have uniquely literature here that deals with suffering in ways that no other literature does. Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing stuff. And I can get kids on board with it very simply. I ask them a question. I say, look, kids, if someone has been had no problems in life and they hit a bump in the road, what happens? Frequently, their lives fall apart. What happens with someone that has had a lot of problems in life and they get another bump? It's another bump.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a way of explaining what happens in Romans when it says in Romans 5 that suffering leads to perseverance, leads to character, leads to what?
Hope.
Hope.
Mm-hmm.
That's what these kids desperately need. Yeah. They need to realize that, you know, they're being trained for later life and that there aren't going to be some bumps in life. You know, the self-help books, for the most part, in the bookstore are wrong, because they say, if you follow this formula, nothing will happen to you, everything will go perfect. And when and when it doesn't, said, well, you didn't follow the book, right?
Right.
No. Proverbs does it differently. Proverbs says, you know, here's in the first 15 chapters, here's what you should do. You know, you need to work in the summer and the harvest so that you have some food in the winter. And that's the wise man, and the fool is the one that's lazy and doesn't do a thing. Okay,
yeah.
I get all that. But from Proverbs 16 to 30, what you have is, hey, what happens when the world doesn't behave the way it's supposed to? What happens when things go wrong? What happens, you know, in suffering and all of that? And, you know, you really realize that the Bible has stuff in literature that no other literature has. And that's what these kids are suffering. We've got something. When we went through with that with the teachers, they were so thrilled that they have something on their in their bookshelf that they didn't realize that they had. They had resources that the kids absolutely positively need, and all of a sudden I was just sort of reminding them of stuff that they kind of knew maybe or they should have known, and they were just, you know, it was just amazing to see how the teachers responded to that. They were just thrilled.
That's great. That's really great. Well, I know you have, you had mentioned before that you have curriculum in 45 states. I know there are a number of states that have actually passed legislation to encourage schools to carry, you know, Bible instruction academically. What about 2019? What is pending? Is there more of a movement now, more states getting on board?
Yeah, we're talking to states, and we pick up on them, you know, periodically. I think we'll pick up two or three. The legislative season, the way it works is that they prepare bills in the fall. December 1 is when they typically introduce them, and then they have a session. Not all legislatures, like Texas's legislature that meets every other year, so, but they've already approved this, so they wouldn't count. But Montana has not approved it, and they meet every other year. But most legislatures meet from January to March. Some, like New York, go into June. And so this is the active time when, you know, connecting with you know, if you know a legislator and can connect with them and say, you know, why don't you think about doing something like this? This is the right thing to do. And we've always gotten bipartisan groups. And, you know, you really need to get both sides, because if you go partisan, then, you know, the other group gets in power, and then they just have to take a whack at you.
Yeah.
If you can get them if you get both sides of the aisle, then, you know, you're good to go, and yeah, No one's going to argue, and you're not going to fight about it. You know, and you shouldn't be fighting about that. This is for the benefit of the kids. And if we need to understand that the kids will do better in school, they'll have better character, and they'll be able to decode the world better around them. I mean, you know, we need to do that, and there's just no, in my view, there's no excuse not to do it.
Well, that's right. And I think it's exciting, too, that you're working with groups to even go around the globe. And this would be a wonderful thing to see happening all across the world, not just in the United States. So very exciting, especially because you've now added this wisdom literature course. And people can find out more information on this, by the way, at teachthebibleinschools.org. Chuck Stetson has been with us, CEO of Essentials in Education. Very exciting work that you're doing, Chuck, and just excited about what you're going to be doing in the future. Thank you so much for what you're doing and for sharing your story with us and letting us know about it.
Great to be with you, Janet.
Thank you. God bless you. Well, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your being with us. We'll be here next time. Thank you for tuning in to Janet Mefford Today.